Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, it's the anniversary of D-Day, the 69th anniversary of the June 6th landing at Normandy. And there couldn't be a better time for us to welcome back to North Carolina Rick Atkinson, whose third book in a trilogy on the war in Europe is being released really as we speak and rushing to the top of the New York Times nonfiction list. Well, Rick, you're a pirate. You're not a Tar Heel. You don't care a thing in the world about being back in Chapel Hill, do you?
Yeah, but I lived in Carrboro briefly in 1975. I had a girlfriend who was at law school here, so I know Chapel Hill a bit and the Triangle area. So, but I am a pirate. I went to East Carolina from 70 to 74.
Well, the people in Chapel Hill love East Carolina, except on game day.
Yeah.
Well, this is the third of a series. One of your two Pulitzer Prizes is for an earlier book in the series on the war in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and now the Allied conquest or reconquest of Europe. I heard one interviewer ask you, "Well, did you just say, I'm glad this is over, or are you miss? Or is this the kind of work that once it's over, you miss?"
I don't really miss it, DG. I've been at it for the better part of 15 years, and it's a long, solitary trek. I do find I'm occasionally a little nostalgia for North Africa, as were the soldiers who fought there. It was a simpler, easier, human-sized conflict there. It's where the U.S. Army first encountered the Germans in the liberation of Europe, the Germans and the Italians. So I do have an occasional pang for North Africa. But as far as the project as a whole is going, I'm perfectly happy that it's done.
The question that everybody must ask you, or everybody asks themselves, is, golly, I mean, this is like the Civil War now. Everybody's writing books about the either about comprehensive books about the war or various aspects of it. What makes you think that you've got something more to say? I mean, that's got to be haunting you as you go through, or at least as you started the series, more than maybe this.
Yeah, I think Amazon.com lists 60,000 hardcover World War II titles, so it's not undiscovered terrain. My feeling was, and this comes in part from having lived in Europe as a kid, my father was an army officer and I was born in Munich and we lived in Salzburg, and then I lived in Berlin for 3 years in the mid-90s as a bureau chief for the Washington Post, that all great events in human history and certainly in American history are bottomless, that there's more to tell, and that 500 years from now, people will still be discovering things about World War II and other people will still be interested in reading about it. I had the insight, I think, when I lived in Europe in the 90s that the liberation of Europe does not begin at Normandy, as so many Americans think, that in fact, to fully understand what happens in that last 11 months of the war from the beaches of Normandy to the surrender of Berlin in May of 1945, it helps to know what came before. And what came before is what I cover in the first two books of this trilogy, the invasion of North Africa, which is November 8, 1942, by American and British soldiers in Morocco and Algeria, and then the campaign across the northern lip of Africa to Tunisia. And then they move across the Mediterranean to Sicily, which we invade on July 10th, 1943. And then southern Italy, which is invaded at Salerno in September of 1943. And really, those set the stage in many ways. The commanders who will arrive at Normandy come out of the Mediterranean. For the most part, Eisenhower, Patton, Omar Bradley, Bernard Montgomery, and so many of the more junior commanders get experience. They're blooded in the Mediterranean. And then many of the tactics and innovations that are vital to the invasion of Normandy and the campaign across Northwest Europe come out of the Mediterranean, like amphibious craft of various kinds, LSTs, landing ship tank, which has a bow door that drops down, and you can drive tanks off of it onto the beach. Those are first used in the Mediterranean. So my feeling is that, yeah, there are a lot of books written about the subject, and people have trod on this ground a bit, but I feel pretty comfortable that, particularly as an archive rat, that I've found quite a few things that are unique in this third and final volume.
There are two things that I found in your book that delighted me, that set your books not apart. I shouldn't say that there aren't others who have done a good job with storytelling and with character development. But I storytelling, I mean, in the sense that the stories that you tell, you often, if we're in Normandy, you want to talk about Shakespeare's plays and their relationship to the British kings who had their homeland in Normandy and were also fighting. You brought to bear poetry from one of our great poets, Randall Jarrell, to help describe the feelings of people. And I kept seeing, where did this guy, who are the models for this kind of writing of history? Where did you go to say, I'm going to infuse my description of the order of battle and the battle with the stories of these humans who are fighting it?
There are many forerunners and people I admire. Shelby Foote's trilogy on the Civil War is something that I have read and liked a great deal and gone back and read passages of it that I find resonant. Bruce Caton wrote two trilogies on the Civil War. I've gone back and reread A Stillness at Appomattox, which is the third and final volume of one of those trilogies, and I mean, it's a lyrical thing, Pulitzer Prize-winning work of history, but very accessible. I think I have my own writing style. I was a newspaperman for a long time, starting on a small paper in Kansas and then Kansas City and then for the better part of a career at the Washington Post. And so I think probably I've drawn on that in various ways, including my research habits and observation of deadlines and the other things that you can pull from the newspaper world. My ambition has always been with this to alternate a tactical foxhole view of what's happening in Normandy or the Hurtgen Forest or the Battle of the Bulge or the encirclement of the Ruhr with a view from on high, an operational or strategic view, so that we shift back and forth between guys who are fighting in the hedgerows and those at even the highest levels, the president, the prime minister, Joseph Stalin, to get their perspective on it because they're making decisions that affect those guys down on the lowest levels. So my ambition is always to glide between those various perspectives as I'm unfolding the story.
Well, how does an experienced journalist approach writing history and doing the research? You mentioned that being a journalist prepared you to do this, but are there things other than what you learned as a newspaper, a researcher and writer that you had to learn to be able to write these wonderful books?
Well, sure. I had to teach myself historiography, among other things.
What is that?
Well, it's the study of history. I had to learn what had been written about this subject and who had done it and what was considered valid or invalid. And I had to learn where the archival troves were. This is something that I had not learned in newspapers. I became a resident, basically, at the National Archives outside of Washington. It's very close to where I live. Or places like the Library of Congress, the U.S. Army Military History Institute. There are many others. There's a couple dozen archives that I use. The things that are useful from, I think, having been in the newspaper business, I think learning how to work quickly, learning how to know what a deadline means and that you've got to observe deadlines, how to set deadlines, how to outline. I'm an inveterate outliner and was as a newspaper reporter, so that I have a roadmap. And in my case, when I'm outlining all the material that I've gathered for a book, it also serves as an index of where the material is. I spend months doing it. And the outline for The Guns at Last Light is three times longer than the book, and the book is quite long. So these are all habits or skills that I try to bring to bear on the task of writing history. It is not journalism. You don't just, it's not just a long newspaper story. The storytelling, the narrative arc, the narrative art is all quite different. And yet you can build on certain foundations that you've learned over the years of being an ink-stained wretch in a newsroom.
We're visiting with Rick Atkinson. We're talking about his brand new book, which begins with Normandy, and coincidentally, we're marking the 69th anniversary of that week. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Rick Atkinson. Rick is the author of a brand new book, which rushed to the top of the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, The Guns at Last Light. It's a history of the last year of the war in Europe. And Rick, there's so many. I enjoy talking to you about how you write and why you write, but there's so many wonderful stories. I think because of the timing, I beg you to tell us in your words about a little bit about Normandy. Your book opens with the in the prologue with a description of this wonderful conference where all the big guys, and I think including the king, come to get briefed about the planned invasion. And it's a good roadmap for us to follow from the plan to what really happened.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the book opens on May 15th, 1944 at St. Paul's School on Hammersmith Road in London. And gathered there are Dwight Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, George Patton, Winston Churchill, King George VI, and most of the senior commanders who have been putting together the plan called Overlord, which is the invasion of France, which will take place 3 weeks later. And they meet in an auditorium where called the Model Room, and on the floor, the cockpit of the auditorium, there's a very large map, 6 inches to the mile, plaster of Paris map showing the portion of Normandy where the River Seine spills into the Atlantic. And what they're gathered to do is to review for a last time the plan, to make sure that they've understood it correctly and that they're all on the same page. And there is a British brigadier wearing no-skid socks, and as they talk about the beaches, Utah, Omaha, Sword, Juneau, Gold, he will glide across this map with a pointer, and he'll point to the geographic designations they're discussing. It lasts all day, does this conference, and it's an opportunity for me not only to march the characters on the stage, who will mostly be with us for the rest of the book, the guys with stars on their shoulders at least, but also to review what they're about to do and to see what it is that they intend to accomplish. It's within the setting of London in the middle of May, which is London's been at war now for 5 years. It's a place of great privation, and of course, it's been bombed heavily, and it's very evocative. And in the midst of all this, there are a couple of million American soldiers gathering in London and Great Britain, country the size of Oregon.
Rick, for this, a couple of million soldiers thinking this is larger than the Research Triangle Park's total population. Our area. This is an enormous.
It's basically the size of the population of the state of Nebraska at the time. So it's as if Nebraska had been transplanted to England. And so that's where the book starts, and it unfolds from there, from that prologue, and then we move on to June 5th, 1944, the eve of the invasion, as they're getting ready to do what they need to do.
Did the planners have any idea, or did the people who were putting on the show share with this group anything close to the kinds of casualties that the operation would take? Did they know that this was going to be that much carnage?
Well, they had very carefully calculated. There are a formula for anticipating what your casualties will be. That's important for planning for medical resources and reinforcements, replacements, that sort of thing. And there were formulas, things called the Evitz rate, in which you plug in the expected opposition and the time period that you're talking about and so on. So, but it's obviously just a guess because you're not sure quite what the resistance will be like. You're not sure what the weather will be like. You know, there are many variables. There was great anxiety about it, of course, that this was throwing a couple hundred thousand young men on the morning of June 6, 1944, into the teeth of a meat grinder. As it turned out, the only beach where things were really, really grim was Omaha, and there had been an underestimation of both the German resistance there. There were more Germans than had been anticipated, and also the softening up, the aerial bombardment and the naval bombardment had been much less effective than had been hoped. Consequently, Omaha was, by the end of the morning of June 6, was bloody Omaha. The other beaches, Utah was relatively easy. That's relatively easy. There were certainly
compared to Omaha.
Compared to Omaha. And the British and Canadian beaches were difficult, but by sunset on June 6, there were Canadian troops who were 6 miles inland. At Omaha, they were not even a mile inland. And so no one really knew. They planned for the worst. They hoped for the best. And it was somewhere in between.
What about the airborne operations?
Well, there were three airborne divisions dropped. This was an intricate part of the plan. There was a belief that the flanks of this invasion force coming by sea needed to be protected. And the way they were going to do that was on the American side of the invasion beaches on the area, the terrain known as the Khotan Tam Peninsula, the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions were going to be dropped by parachute and others would be landing by glider. And then on the other side of the beachhead, on the British end, the British had an airborne division that would be dropped. Casualties were very high at both ends of the beachhead. There was a lot of confusion, as there always is in airborne operation. There were many, many paratroopers who were dropped away from where they were supposed to be. The confusion actually cut both ways, though. It confused the Germans, and even though they had stout resistance and there were many casualties inflicted, the Germans felt as though they had Allied soldiers everywhere around them, including behind them, which they certainly did. And so the intent of the airborne operation was to secure the flanks in order to prevent the Germans from counterattacking when the landing forces were on the beaches, when they were most vulnerable. And in this regard, they were quite successful.
Well, you mentioned the sort of the post-landing phase of the war, and immediately, as I learned from your book, it became a delivery of supply challenge that seemed to be almost as important, if not more important, than what was going on in terms of success on the ground. And you described this eloquently. What were the supply challenges, and how did the Allies overcome them?
Well, the supply challenges are enormous because you're trying to outfit a mechanized force of ultimately several million soldiers moving long distances across Europe. And right from the beginning, right from June 6, this is a vital part of what you're doing. You've got to have ammunition, you've got to have fuel, you've got to have food and all the rest, surgical supplies, everything that an invasion force needs. The reason that the invasion was launched at Normandy was precisely to capture a port, and the port was Cherbourg. And the need for a port is driven by the need to be able to unload large ships, freighters of various kinds, tankers, all of which is part of the effort of getting ashore the things that you need to sustain this industrial strength military operation. Cherbourg was not captured until several weeks after the invasion, and the Germans had used the interim period to thoroughly demolish it. They had a genius for destruction, and they blew up everything they could blow up in Cherbourg. And so it would be weeks and then months before Cherbourg was fully operational again. And still, that did not solve the logistical needs, because Cherbourg is relatively small. You're moving ashore hundreds of thousands of soldiers. And so finding more port capacity and being able to sustain the force that's now engaged in heavy combat, where you're using millions, ultimately, of tons of ammunition and fuel and so on. Looking for another port becomes an important part of the campaign. Antwerp was absolutely critical, and so that's an important part of the story.
Well, they captured Antwerp.
They captured Antwerp, but it was a terrible intelligence and operational failure, because they captured Antwerp.
This is just for, I mean, I guess our listeners don't have a map, but this is in Belgium.
It is, and yeah.
But it was capturable before Amsterdam or before any of the other larger ports were going to be available.
Yeah, it's situated in a way that once the Germans are pushed out of Normandy, and that takes most of the summer, and Paris is liberated on August 25th, 1944, it's Katie bar the door, and we're off to the races. The Germans have no real ability to resist as we move across France and into the Low Countries. And so Brussels is liberated, and Antwerp is captured by the British.
So the problems are solved.
Yeah, you would think, because the port at Antwerp, which is enormous, was virtually unscathed. The Germans had not had time to do what they had done in Cherbourg. But the problem is Antwerp is set inland a bit, and it's on a river called the Scheldt. And if you don't control the Scheldt, the approach, then you don't control Antwerp.
For those of us who live in North Carolina, it's kind of like Wilmington up the Cape Fear River.
Very much.
You could imagine controlling Wilmington, but if you don't control both sides of the Cape Fear all the way down to the ocean, it doesn't do you any good.
That's exactly right, DG. And in the case of the Scheldt, it's an 80-mile approach. And the Germans recognized before the Allies did that this was vital, and they reinforced the approaches along the Scheldt. And so even though the port was captured in early September, the Scheldt was not usable until late November. It was a disaster of the first order, and there were consequently shortages of fuel and ammunition and all the other vital necessities.
You got millions of soldiers on the ground in Europe, and you don't have enough. You don't have a good enough way to supply them with the things they need to move.
Well, that's right, and one of the reasons that there was also an invasion of southern France, and I write about this at some length because most Americans know very little about it. On August 15th, 1944. A combined American and French force landed near Saint-Tropez and landed without much resistance from the Germans.
Excuse me for interrupting you about this, but I love this part of the story because one of my great heroes, Winston Churchill, who knew everything, said this was a stupid thing. He didn't use those. I mean, the British were not in favor of this.
No, he said it was stupid. He minced no words about it. No, Churchill in particular was opposed to it. It required peeling forces away from Italy, where we're still fighting. He thought that it added nothing to the effort to get into Germany.
He had an alternate, I guess, did he?
Yeah, he thought that an invasion at the head of the Adriatic Sea on the other side, the eastern side of Italy, and going through a terrain feature known as the Ljubljana Gap, which is an approach to Vienna, would be a good idea. Eisenhower said he wasn't going through any gap he couldn't pronounce. and it was a foolish idea that Churchill had, actually. And the Americans essentially overruled him. By this point, we are very much the big kid on the block. And Churchill became he almost literally frothing at the mouth about this plan, which he opposed. And nevertheless, we did it. We invaded with the French. We went up the Rhone River Valley, turned right at Lyon, through the Vosges Mountains in the early winter, and we're on captured Strasbourg, liberated Strasbourg, and we're on the
from
Rhine
the south,
River.
Not rather than from
yeah,
Germany,
from the south, and then from the west. Yep.
We need to take a break. I hate to do it. I'm enjoying visiting with Rick Adkinson, whose we got to call it a brand new book.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Guns at Last Light. has shot to the top of the nonfiction bestseller list of the New York Times, and we'll continue our conversation with him after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Rick Atkinson, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, graduate of East Carolina University, is back in North Carolina to promote his new book, the third in a trilogy of books about the war, World War II in Europe. And this book is The Guns at Last Light. It's a history of the last part of the war. And I mean, you're just so calm, cool, and collected. You're not celebrating that you've done this, that you got this book done, and now it's at the top of the bestseller list. I mean, I would be having the kinds of parties you describe that the generals had after victories in this war.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say. It's just, you know, I'm pleased about the reception. It's selling very well. The critical reviews have been great. And you know, I'm going back to work real soon. I've got another project.
Well, we're going to talk about your next project, but right now, I love these character studies, and I think although this is not brand new, the characters of General Montgomery as up against or up with his partner General Eisenhower, with Omar Bradley, this guy, really the head of the governmental head of the army, and I can't remember his name, who was Montgomery's partner in criticizing.
Alan Brooke.
Yeah, Alan Brooke. Is he Viscount Alan Brooke?
He was, not at the time of the war.
But here's a group of people who really have no deep respect for, at least for Eisenhower's ability as a commander-in-chief. Tell us about these people.
Yeah, again, they've all been together from the Mediterranean, so they've got a lot of history, and it's not always pretty. The belief that Montgomery had of Eisenhower's incapacity as a field general has some truth to it. Eisenhower's not a very good field marshal. He's not a natural battle captain. He doesn't see the field spatially and temporally as Napoleon would, for example. And Montgomery's a little disdainful of him. And Montgomery's also very self-centered, very self-involved, and absolutely insufferable at times. So there have been frictions that had played out in Africa and then in Sicily and southern Italy. And they really come to the fore in Western Europe when there are two different ideas about the best way to smash the Third Reich. Eisenhower's view is that you should have a broad attack into Germany, two central prongs reinforcing one another. Montgomery's view was that this was a dissipation of effort and they should have one mighty blow in one spot, preferably in his sector in the northern part of the line. And they disputed this for months and went back and forth. Now, Eisenhower is Montgomery's superior, so he basically holds the trump cards. But Montgomery is not a guy to let things go easily. And he's venting constantly in letters back to London, and including notes to General Brooke. It gets quite ugly, so that at one point Eisenhower says, and this is in the winter of 44-45, it's me or him. The combined chiefs, our masters in London and Washington, are going to have to make a decision because I can't work with this guy anymore. Well, Montgomery at that point realizes it's not going to be me or him, Eisenhower, Montgomery. It's going to be Montgomery if anybody gets thrown over the side. Eisenhower is the indispensable man, and he backs off a bit, and they patch things over, but it's only a patch, and there are continual frictions. So it's just part of the human nature of warfare. The stakes are so high, the personal wills are so strong that there's a kind of inevitability that frictions develop in between personalities. And that friction certainly is among the more singular during the war.
Did you find out anything new about this? I mean, we've talked about the it's not new that these guys had a challenge in terms of getting.
No, they vented it quite freely, both in letters at the time, but then right after the war, everybody's getting their point of view across after the war about who won the war and who was right and who was wrong and so on. There's a lot of new stuff in this book with regard to Eisenhower and Montgomery, the frictions between them. That's fairly well trod ground. I did find some letters and so on that were new on the subject, but I've put most of my effort in trying to come up with new things on other fronts.
Well, one of the things that you came up with that surely I had never heard of before, and this has to do with the challenge of supplying the troops. And there, a guy wound up in charge of the whole Allied supply effort. And you think of this enormous challenge of logistically of supplying millions of people and on top of for daily life, on top of the ammunition needs, the whole supply chain. And there's this character whom you describe. General Courthouse Lee.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about him and why was it important to describe him? I loved this section.
Yeah, well, he's a memorable character. His name is John C.H. Lee, and some called him John Courthouse Lee or Jesus Christ himself Lee. He was a West Point classmate of Patton's, so he's older than Eisenhower, and he is the chief logistician, basically, for the American forces in Europe. So he's got an immensely important job. He's a very imperious character, and many people loathed him, but everyone was afraid of him because he controlled everything from the amount of gasoline you would get to the number of bottles of whiskey general officers could receive. He controls the supply taps. He lived grandly. He had a series of suites in Paris where he lived. He had a retinue that included a chiropractor and his personal publicist. He was very religious. He kept Bibles in his briefcase and in his desk. He would go to church at least once a day, and on Sunday sometimes as many as three times a day, dragging along this retinue with him. His driver was a lay Baptist preacher. So he's a great character. He's not incompetent, but he's not terribly competent either. He's up against a lot. It's not all the problems are not all of his making, but in some ways he exacerbates them partly by his personality. He's a guy that's very difficult to like. He would show up for an inspection at a hospital and patients, these are wounded soldiers in their beds, would be forced to lie at attention. So he's a great character to write about, and the book, the story is just full of characters
is.
Like
it's
this.
It's just wonderful. And again, we're talking to Rick Atkinson about his New York Times nonfiction number one bestseller, The Guns at Last Light, the third in a trilogy about the war in Europe. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Rick Atkinson. If you joined us late, he is the author of his third book in a trilogy of books about the war in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Europe. This one, The Guns at Last Light, it takes us from the Normandy invasion all the way through to the German surrender. There's so many different characters, Rick Atkinson, that I liked. One of the ones that you described, never heard of, probably never would have heard of it if it hadn't been for you, is a young German officer who sort of takes the lead in the Battle of the Bulge. Can you tell us about him and what he did and why he kind of collapsed into infamy?
Well, his name is Lieutenant Colonel Jochen Peiper. He's a young SS officer, and his job is to be the Spitze, as the Germans say, the point of the spear, basically. When the Battle of the Bulge begins on December 16, 1944, Piper's job is to lead an armored column through the American defenses and try to get to the Meuse River, which is about 60 miles away. This is through the Belgian Ardennes, very hilly, very rugged country in the middle of the winter. And from the Meuse, once the Germans have captured bridges across this river, they're going to try to get to Antwerp and capture the port and splitting the British from the Americans. Piper is a very capable officer. He's also completely ruthless. And his timetable is upset right from the beginning for various reasons. he, among other things, encounters strictly by accident an American convoy that is passing near the Belgian town of Malmedy, and the convoy is shot up. The Americans who are not killed are captured. They're lined up in a field. And then Piper leaves. He goes ahead a bit, and the men he leaves behind gun down the Americans.
This is an execution of prisoners.
It's a cold-blooded killing. It's infamous, one of the most infamous deeds in the European War. Piper didn't know about it, but he certainly knew about other killings that were occurring by his men of both Belgian civilians and American soldiers elsewhere. His effort to get to the Meuse falls short by several miles. He's running out of fuel. He's under heavy artillery attack by American counterattacking forces. So he never gets there, and his force is largely shot to pieces. He gets away. He's captured after the war, at the end of the war, and tried, along with dozens of others who are involved in the Malmedy killings and other murders. And he's found guilty, and along with several dozen others, is sentenced to death. It was found that the confessions and other evidence used in the trial were tainted. And the confessions were thrown out. They were extracted under circumstances that we in this country deem inappropriate. Yeah, it's just you can't do that legally. And so the death sentences were vacated. He spent about 10 years in prison and then was let out in the mid-50s. He became a salesman for Porsche, the auto company, and later for Volkswagen. He was responsible for selling cars and other vehicles to Americans. He was murdered in the early 70s. He had a house in eastern France. The house was set fire to. There was an arson. The cause, the culprit was never discovered. It's an unsolved killing. Piper's charred body was found inside. So he's a terrible character, but very interesting, quite charming, reasonably cultured and educated. He spoke English very well. He spoke French. He had two brothers who'd been killed in the war. So
he reminded me of this. Now I'm about to launch into something I don't know. This Quentin Tarantino film where the German officer who, what was the guy's name, who was so sophisticated, you know, nice, but he was just absolutely brutal, willing to kill anybody. And it, I guess that's what caught me. Mm-hmm. Now listen, we could. There's just so much to talk about in your book, but. A lot of your fans are sorry that the trilogy is now at an end. So what do you do now?
Well, I'm going to leave World War II. I decided some time ago I wasn't going to do the Pacific. Among other things, it would require me to go back in time for this war and start over, essentially, at Pearl Harbor. 15 years, I think, is long enough to spend on one thing. So I'm going to do a trilogy, and publisher Henry Holt has announced this recently, on a trilogy about the American Revolution. And I hope to bring to it the same techniques that I've used for the Liberation Trilogy, heavily focused on character, heavily focused on the British and the Germans, and to some extent the French, as well as the Americans. And I always believe that the narrative writer's true calling is to bring back the dead. So I will be looking for characters that you may not know, in addition to the ones that.
So George Washington as Dwight Eisenhower.
There are parallels that I do see, so that's what I'm going to do.
And how far along are you? Have you identified where the sources are in terms of the archives where you'll be spending most of your time?
I'm not very far. I've done some reading, a lot of reading over the last year, but I have not started archival research. Yeah, it's a whole different set of archives, of course. It'd be too simple to go back to the places I know well now. So Ann Arbor, for example, the William Clements Library is fantastic. It's one of the great repositories of documents on this subject. There are places in Washington, the Society of the Cincinnati has a big library. Every little town in New England has an archive of some sort. The New York Historical Society, there are archives in California, for example. So it's and of course in Britain, I spent a lot of time researching the Liberation Trilogy at various British archives, and I will do the same for this.
I hope you'll come back and visit with us.
Thanks
again.
Very much, DJ. I appreciate that.
Our guest has been Rick Atkinson, the author of the trilogy on World War II in Europe, celebrating the latest book, and its status now as we speak is the number one New York Times bestseller on the nonfiction list. Rick, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.